We're talking about a special session on gun legislation, and you've aligned to Representative Jim Steinecke here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As you heard, Governor Evers is calling the legislature into a special session next month to take up a pair of bills that so far Republican leaders have been unwilling to debate in session. So how do you want to see lawmakers addressing issues around gun violence? Where do you see a compromise between the parties? We're at 800-642-1234. Republican State Representative Jim Steinecke of Kaukauna is Assembly Majority Leader. Representative Steinecke, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
So the legislature will convene on November 7th to consider two Democratic proposals that would place more restrictions around guns. How do you anticipate the legislature might work together on this?
Well, I think it's important to realize that I think everybody, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, are frustrated by some of the mass shootings that are going on throughout the country, and everybody's looking for solutions, and politicians generally want to rush out to make sure that we do something to address it. I think the difference between the two approaches between Democrats and Republicans is Democrats are focused on the guns. The Republicans are more focused on what we believe are the causes of mass shootings. And if you look at the LA Times study on mass shootings, 26 out of the 27 mass shooters that they studied have some instances of childhood trauma that affected them for the rest of their lives leading up to these mass shootings. Those are the kind of things that we want to focus on instead of focusing on curtailing people's rights.
Well, after the Parkland High School shooting that last year that left 17 dead, Governor Walker called a special session. It was to advance those $100 million in school safety measures. Governor Walker's proposal did not include any gun control measures. Do you see this special session in any light a continuation of the legislature's policy work around gun safety?
No, because I just don't think that there's enough support to pass the legislation that the Democrats are offering on this. I mean, if you look at the expanded background checks that they're talking about, the universal background checks, really what they're talking about is regulating private sales. Private sales are incredibly difficult to, background checks on private sales would be incredibly difficult to enforce. There's no real way to enforce that unless you have a national gun registry, which I don't believe this is ever going to happen. And then on the other side, with the red flag laws, you have a lot of, it's really ripe for abuse because you don't really have due process in place for people that are accused of being unfit to have a weapon, and those weapons can be taken away without their due process rights being taken into consideration.
And so you find in the court of law, when you, raise a red flag where a judge takes a gun away, that due process just isn't there, that this is a slippery slope.
Right, because, well, it does short-circuit the process. The guns are taken away without an extensive hearing of the facts, and that's problematic because I think we can all agree that there are going to be cases in if this were to pass where you'd have disgruntled exes that would make claims that were unsubstantiated. And these judges are elected officials at the end of the day, and there's going to be pressure on them to take away the guns first and then, just to be on the safe side so that something bad doesn't happen down the line.
Is there a better alternative than a red flag law? Do you see that the court system could do something different here?
Yeah, I mean, we've been looking at things nationally. Again, one of the things that I'm focused on is trying to get at the problem at a very early age. I'm going to be announcing a bill here in the next couple of weeks that will develop a pilot program to deliver mental health care access directly into the schools in a way that we haven't done before so that schools can get the help that they need when dealing with these kids that are presenting with mental health issues early on in life. I think that's where we really need to attack the problem to make sure that they don't end up becoming these mass shooters later on in life.
What would funding levels need to be to have adequate mental health at an early age in those younger years in school?
Yeah, I think we can actually do it at a reasonable cost. We basically piggyback off of an idea that Senator Darling and I introduced a few years ago, which is called the CPCP. It's the Child Psychiatry Consultation Program. And at that time, that was put in place for pediatricians to call into this hotline to get help with their patients that are presenting with mental health challenges. What we're looking to do is expand that to the schools in a pilot program just to see how much use it would get, how much it would cost, and how we could deliver those services. And that's something that we're pretty excited about, and the schools we've talked to are really excited about as well.
We're talking with Representative Jim Steinke, the Wisconsin Assembly Majority Leader, about a pair of gun safety bills. Governor Tony Evers wants the legislature to address in a special session next month. You have a line at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Representative, yesterday out of Minnesota, Minnesota's governor tweeted that he won't be calling a special session on gun control legislation this fall, saying it would be futile because of opposition from Republicans who control the state Senate there. Should we have the same mindset here in Wisconsin that because Republicans control both chambers, why are we even talking about gun legislation?
Well, and I agree with the governor in Minnesota's approach, because instead of focusing on the issues that divide us, I think we should focus on the issues where we can come together and really present some solutions that will have a greater impact. That's what we're focused on, like I said, with trying to expand access to mental health care and other things that will actually address the root cause of the problem. It's unfortunate that Governor Evers decided to do this knowing that there wasn't the support there, but that's fully within his rights. We're just concerned that if you were to pass legislation like this, invariably it's not going to solve the problem. And then what's next? Seems to be a constant push towards eroding people's rights. And you see that at the national level with some of the candidates running for the Democratic candidates running for president. Talking about things like mandatory gun buybacks, which the governor has said he would consider. That's troubling for a lot of people in Wisconsin.
So mandatory gun buybacks, you had mentioned these buybacks would never happen as long as Republicans are in control of the state house. Do you feel as confident now with a special session at hand?
As far as mandatory gun buybacks?
Yeah, as far as considering, mandatory gun buybacks.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you have Republicans in the Assembly and Senate that are in control, you will never see mandatory gun buybacks in the state. It's gun confiscation, plain and simple. And the only people you're going to affect are already the law-abiding people of the state. Criminals that are more likely to, obviously, commit crimes with guns are not going to follow a mandatory gun buyback program.
Representative, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
State Representative Jim Steinke is the Assembly Majority Leader. He is a Republican from Kaukauna. Coming up, we look at what recent poll numbers tell us about who Americans trust more, the U.S. Supreme Court, Congress, or the presidency. How do you feel about the Supreme Court these days? Are you confident in the court's decisions? Are you concerned? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment to look at polling on the U.S. Supreme Court on a nationwide level. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new poll out of Marquette University that gauges public perception of the U.S. Supreme Court. We're getting takeaways from the poll here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The law school interviewed more than 1,400 adults nationwide last month and their confidence in the high court. So what rulings have shaped your views of the U.S. Supreme Court? What have you felt the court's decisions were right or wrong? What rulings come up for you? Should high court justices pass the torch and retire? And if so, when should they step down? Join in at 800-642-1234. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School Poll, and he's a professor of law and public policy. He's co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So how does public trust in the Supreme Court compare to other branches of government? What did you find out there regarding Congress and the presidency as it stacks up to the Supreme Court?
By this standard, the court does quite well. 57% say that they have the highest confidence in the court. It's 22% for Congress and 21% for the presidency. This is a longstanding finding that the public has confidence in the court. It's not unlimited confidence, as we've seen confidence in all areas of government decline over the last few decades. But it's still substantial, and in comparison to the other branches of government, the court stands out as especially receiving the public's confidence.
Well, what happens when you draw political lines here? Do Democrats or Republicans view the court more favorably?
As with almost everything in politics, there's a party line, and that ranges from 54% high confidence among Republicans to 34% high confidence with Democrats. So it's about a 20-point gap. On the other hand, the opposite end is not as sharp. If you look at low confidence, that's at 14% with Republicans, but just 21% low confidence among Democrats. And so while you do see some variation in the high end, I think it's worth noting that even among Democrats who are a bit more skeptical of the court, it's still barely one in five that are in the low confidence group. And it was 14% among Republicans, so not a big increase in the number of Democrats who completely lack confidence in the court.
Okay, so in your polling, does the public support President Trump's handling of Supreme Court nominations so far? What did you find there?
Yeah, that's a case where the public is split on President Trump in ways that are not too different from the way they're divided over his handling of his job overall. In our poll, which was early September, 22% strongly approve of the way Trump has handled nominations, and another 21% somewhat approve. So 43% approve, 38% strongly disapprove, and 19% somewhat disapprove. So that's about 57% disapprove. So 43-57. It was a little more negative to the president in this poll overall. 40% approve, 60% disapprove. So in that, his net handling of the court is a little bit better than his net handling of the job overall, but there are not big differences between the two.
We're talking numbers about the U.S. Supreme Court in light of this new national polling data out of Marquette University. Professor Charles Franklin, our guide, he's director of the university's law school poll. You can join in the conversation at any point this hour with your questions or your thoughts about SCOTUS, the nation's highest court. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Charles, the poll asked about seven major rulings, including decisions on gun rights, marriage equality, campaign finance, college admissions, affirmative action there. Which of the rulings were the most popular?
Well, you see a range from strong positive evaluation, support for same-sex marriage, for example, but the most negative evaluations going to the use of race in college admissions and also the unlimited use of corporate money in political campaigns.
Citizens United.
Citizens United is the case. And so that range actually shows that despite the overall high approval or satisfaction with the court, there are divisions in which cases a majority of the public supports and which cases a majority opposes. Like with confidence, these are structured by partisanship and ideology, but to varying degrees. Some cases are very strongly aligned with party and ideology, like opinion about a possible future decision on the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Others, like actually Citizens United, the campaign finance case, the party and ideology structuring is quite weak. Not zero, but quite weak. So those kinds of variations that we see include net very positive evaluations of some more liberal decisions, like same-sex marriage, and net opposition to some other liberal decisions, like use of race in college admissions.
What were respondents' thoughts on D.C. versus Heller and the Second Amendment and individuals' right to bear arms? What did you find there?
We asked two questions. One is about the original Heller decision, where the court ruled that the Second Amendment did allow a personal right to possess a firearm, though the court qualified that by saying possess a firearm for self-defense in the home. And we get a large support for that. 67% favor that decision, 24% oppose it. But that's not an unqualified support for gun rights. We asked about a hypothetical case. This is not one that's currently before the court. But we asked about if there were a ban on semi-automatic rifles, does the Second Amendment prohibit that ban? In other words, is the Second Amendment overruling of a ban on semi-automatic rifles? And there, the majority flipped. It was now 53% would say they opposed overturning a ban. In other words, they'd rather have the ban than have the Second Amendment. 39% said that the Second Amendment would prohibit banning semi-automatic rifles. So here you see the flip. On the one hand, personal possession of a firearm, very strong majority support. But today, as we talk about the issue of semi-automatic rifles, the public is not as convinced that the Second Amendment would prohibit that kind of a policy.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Lou is joining us from Oconomowoc. Hi, Lou.
Hi there. Good morning. I was just telling your call screener that for me, the Citizen United decision by the Supreme Court a number of years ago really has changed the tide in this country, and I think it's wrestled a lot of the democratic process away from we the people. Like I say, to call corporations, you know, human beings and whatnot is just, it flies in the face of just reality, and you know, and it begs the question: when is big money and big corporations, when are they going to be pulled back from, basically controlling a lot of the elections, putting a lot of money, dark money that nobody knows where it's coming from? There's no openness anymore with these folks, and Citizens United made that a real deal. And I had to laugh. I was just telling your call screener, but you just won a point. You know, the bumper sticker says, "I'll believe in Citizens United when I see the first corporation executed," any man and woman in this country would be.
All right. Lou, let's go back to Charles Franklin here a moment on Citizens United. And Lou has very strong feelings about this particular case.
And is joined by citizens, united or not, ordinary citizens. This is really quite a striking finding that 75% oppose that decision. And of that, 53% feel strongly about it, not unlike Lou. Just 3% say that was a, they strongly favor the decision. Another 11 say somewhat favor. This is, as we said earlier, the most lopsided opposition to a past decision. And it's one where the structuring of party is really pretty minimal. There are very modest differences by partisanship or ideology. Instead, across the board, this is not a decision that the public supports.
We're talking about the first ever National Marquette University Law School poll that's taking the pulse on public views of the U.S. Supreme Court. Charles Franklin, our guide, he directs the Marquette poll. Your thoughts as well. Are you confident in the court's decisions, or are you worried by what you see in writings from the high court? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation with Charles Franklin after news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.
NPR.
A new national poll out of Marquette University finds the overall confidence in the Supreme Court is more pronounced among conservatives. It's one takeaway as we're talking about this poll on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Marquette poll offers a glimpse of public perceptions on a range of issues with the high court, from its handling of individual cases, as we've been talking about, major rulings, to how individual justices conduct themselves on the bench, to the broader role of the court's impact on our society. So what do you think about Chief Justice John Roberts and his handling of the Supreme Court? How do you feel about President Trump's picks for the high court? Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. Join in at 800-642-1234. Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School poll, professor of law and public policy. He stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Stephen is joining us from Madison. Hi, Stephen.
Hi there. How are you guys doing today? I appreciate listening to the show this morning. I had a question regarding any findings from the survey or observations regarding how the Supreme Court is managing their other areas of responsibilities with building out and managing the overall federal court system, the different districts, and how rulings are handled at that level and then brought up. Was there anything in the survey that shed light on the perception of how that's done?
Stephen, thanks so much. Question about the broader framework. Charles?
Right. No, we didn't ask about that. I suspect that ordinary citizens, as opposed to those really involved in the law, don't have very strong perceptions or knowledge about it. We did ask about nominations and what criteria people were hoping for in judges and nominees. And we did also ask about confidence in state Supreme Courts, which were a little bit lower than the U.S. Supreme Court, but still the second highest level of confidence. But I'm sorry to say that's as far as we got with other responsibilities of the justices.
Well, Stephen, you might find this interesting because we're getting a little bit more into the nuance of the court. Some Democrats running for president want to expand the Supreme Court. Among others, liberal justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has publicly opposed that idea.
Well, if anything would make the court appear partisan, it would be that one side saying, when we're in power, we're going to enlarge the number of judges, so we will have more people who will vote the way we want them.
So that was Ginsburg in an interview over the summer with NPR. Charles, what did you learn from polling a public opinion on expanding the court?
A majority agree with Justice Ginsburg and oppose an expansion, but most people don't have very strong feelings about this. So 17% strongly opposed an increase in the size, 40% somewhat opposed it, so 57% opposed. And on the pro-expansion side, just 8% are strongly in favor of expanding the size, but 35% are somewhat in favor. So you've got 75% of the people in this middle wishy-washy category, and I think that means they haven't thought much about it, haven't really decided, and don't feel strongly about it. I think this expansion of the court is an interesting example of the way outside political forces affect the way people think about and feel about the court. this is an excuse me, an issue that has emerged from political campaigns and groups that care a lot about the court, raising this idea of expanding the size. That's something that now the justices are caught up in, even though it's an issue that they did not make, and as you see in Justice Ginsburg's case, are skeptical of. In a broader sense, it shows how the politicization of the court is something that, in large part, is created through the political conflict in the nomination and confirmation process, things that happen in the U.S. Senate over that, things that interest groups raise as reasons to support or oppose particular nominees. And all of those things are out of the control of the justices. What the justices control is the way they decide cases. And as we saw, people have feelings about those cases. But the court is more than the other institutions not in control of the way other actors make the court more or less political. And the court expansion that we're talking about is a good example of that, an idea that really hadn't been talked about since the 1937 court packing plan of Franklin Roosevelt failed. And now we're seeing this come back 70 years later, maybe, or 80 years later.
80.
my math,
do the math?
Not good in the morning.
No, that's okay.
but my point is, there was a celebrated case of an idea that failed and was shelved for a long, long time. But now, for other reasons about political fights over the court, that's an idea that is back on the agenda. The public, as you can see, hasn't thought a lot about it and on balance opposes it. But that can change if the presidential debate emphasizes it more, or if in the future actual legislation was introduced.
Well, it bears in mind something that came up yesterday in your panel discussions that I heard, that, you know, the court is a divided body. They don't agree a lot in their writings, but they protect each other. Does that protection of each other, standing up for each other and the bench, does that play into public perception at all?
Well, it's hard to say. Balanced opinions about the justices themselves is the norm. We saw that lots of people do not have an opinion about individual justices. They are far from the most visible folks. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the most visible in our survey, but still 41 or 2%. Were unable to give a positive or negative rating to her. So
even after a movie.
Even with a movie, that's
okay.
Right. But even with that unusually high profile, you know, 4 in 10 don't really have an opinion about her, and it goes all the way up to 84% that lacked an opinion of Justice Breyer. So my point is, I don't know that the day-to-day activities of the justices plays a big role. On the other hand, Chief Justice Roberts has given speeches in which he explicitly emphasizes the nonpartisan divisions on the court. They're not Democratic justices or Republican justices, Trump justices or Obama justices or Bush justices. All of those are phrases that he's used in attempting to say to the public, we are not the partisan body that the U.S. Senate is. Don't think of what we do in those terms. Having said that, there are clear ideological differences among the justices, or if you prefer, philosophical differences in how to understand and interpret the law. And those differences do follow party lines, more or less. This is also an important change in the court. Over the last few years, we've seen several justices who were more moderate or even had been appointed by Republican presidents but had developed a somewhat liberal judicial outlook. They've all left the court. So right at the moment, we are at a point where we have five justices appointed by Republicans who are identifiably conservative, four justices appointed by Democrats who are identifiably liberal, and there are probably a couple of those that are somewhat swing votes.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, the court is more aligned by party and ideology now than it had been when, say, David Souter was on the court, or even Justice Kennedy, who recently retired.
We're talking with Professor Charles Franklin about Marquette University's new poll on the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's take a call now. Kate is joining us from Madison. Hi, Kate.
Hi. I was wondering if the poll covered any opinion regarding Merrick Garland's nomination and the obstruction for whether or not he was able to be voted on to the court, and also whether or not that's ever going to be revisited.
Great questions, Kate. Charles, go ahead.
Well, indeed, we did ask about the Garland nomination and nominations in a presidential election year. With the benefit of hindsight, the public is overwhelmingly negative about the Garland decision not to hold hearings, or the decision not to hold hearings on Garland's nomination.
So, and just like to back up here, in 2016, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell refused to hold confirmation hearings for President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland. Go ahead.
No, thank you for clarifying. And blocked that hearing for the entire year. So President Trump got to make the nomination when he took office. 73% say blocking that was the wrong thing to do. 27% say it was the right thing to do. And even among Republicans, 55% say it was the wrong decision, 45% the right. And less surprisingly, among Democrats, 87% say it was wrong. So a sharp party divide on that. But it does carry over. We asked, if there's a vacancy in 2020 during a presidential year, should the Senate hold hearings? 69% say they should, but 31% say they should not. And that comes in part from 37 or 38% of Democrats who say no hearings, which, given how much they thought there should have been Garland hearings, probably reflects some payback. But even 28% of Republicans seem to have been convinced by McConnell's argument of no hearings in a presidential year. And so this is the way that fights escalate a little bit, with now more people skeptical of presidential year appointments.
We're looking at new polling data out of Marquette University on the U.S. Supreme Court. Charles Franklin, our guide, he directs the Marquette poll. Your thoughts on it, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're looking at a new nationwide Marquette Law School poll out this week. This new polling data comes out of more than 1,400 interviews with adults last month. It found that Americans trust the Supreme Court far more than other branches of government, and that they don't view it as an extremely partisan institution. So what rulings have shaped your view of the high court? When have you felt disappointment in the Supreme Court's decision to reject an appeal? When did you want the court to take up an issue, but they declined? Still time for your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Charles Franklin stays with us. He directs the Marquette University Law School poll. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
You know, I just wonder how much of the polling is influenced by the media. A perfect example is a couple callers ago, we talked about the Citizens United, and I know so many people who were against that decision, but when you actually go to the details of what the case was about, it was about a movie and when the movie could be played. And when you talk about the details, they would support Citizens United. So I'm just wondering how much the media influences the polls for people who are just ignorant until the media tells them what to think.
Steve, thanks for the call. Charles Franklin, what is the impact of the press and certainly even social media?
I would put it slightly differently, but I agree with the basic premise that what the court does is filtered through media coverage. You know, in principle, we could all jump on the internet in the mornings and read decisions, 30, 40, 60-page decisions. But very few of us have the motivation or the time or the interest to do that. And so what we get is a, you know, more popular explanation, a more simplified explanation. Now, Citizens United was about a movie, but the thrust of the decision was to allow unlimited expenditures by corporations and labor unions in political activities. And so I think that is a adequate summary of it, but it avoids the issue that Steve wanted to raise about, you know, the sort of details of the Citizens United case. Very few people get to the level of what are all the details, what statutory or constitutional issues are at stake, are critically important issues for the justices in deciding cases, but they are so technical in many, not all, but in many cases, that it's difficult to convey the complexity of decisions. And so as a result, we have the press and commentators and people like me asking questions about this or telling about this in a simplified way that you can convey in a 600-word news story, say. So I think this is intrinsic, though. It's not unique to politics. If you think of coverage of the Congress, we don't usually read about committee hearings and bill markup and all the alternatives that were considered in a committee. Instead, we get the gist of what the Congress decided to do, or presidential actions, or diplomacy, and right. So on.
And
this kind of limitation is very common across government, not unique to the court.
Well, then there's also reporting on process. Justice Brett Kavanaugh was really critical of the Senate confirmation process during his divisive appointment last year, and he forecasted long-term impacts on public opinion from how he was treated.
This is a circus. The consequences will extend long past my nomination. The consequences will be with us for decades.
Does the poll suggest any change in public opinion of the Supreme Court after the Kavanaugh hearings?
We did not have a previous survey, so okay. I can't say from our data that it's changed. We certainly saw at the time of the Kavanaugh hearings, when we did ask about it in Wisconsin polling, that voters were divided about it, with some supporting him, but almost an equal number supporting Ford, his critic and accuser in those hearings. We've not asked about whether people like the process of hearings. That's something to explore later. But I think in the broader picture, if you look at what's happened with hearings for nominees since, say, the 1970s, there's been a progression in which some justices go through with relatively uneventful hearings. I would actually point to the Gorsuch appointment, the first Trump appointment, that was controversial and it had a divided Senate, but was largely without major fireworks or controversy, whereas the Kavanaugh hearing was quite different in that respect. But there's no question that votes now in the Senate follow partisan lines much more strongly than they did as recently as the 1990s or before.
Let's bring in Marcus now in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. So I was wondering if your research addressed any of the cases around the two for gerrymandering and the fact that the Supreme Court did not come with a bright line ruling. Rather, they kicked it back down to the lower courts and left it to them.
Right. We did ask about that. And the first thing to say is that that case was so important to a lot of people. But 29% say they don't have an opinion about the case, which shows the difficulty of the public learning about and appreciating the importance of some cases, this one in particular. On balance, we found that 45% opposed that ruling that the court would not decide partisan gerrymanders. 26% favored the ruling. So the balance of opinion is to oppose that decision to stay out of gerrymandering. But it's sort of a surprisingly high. That 29% was the most that lacked an opinion on 14 cases we asked about.
Marcus, thanks so much for the call. Charles, you've overseen the Marquette Law School poll since it started in 2012. This poll on the U.S. Supreme Court is a first for you, studying national public opinion. Why hasn't the law school poll previously looked at national opinion?
Well, there are a lot of organizations that do national public opinion polls. And so it raises the question of what is our unique contribution. In contrast, there are very few organizations that regularly poll Wisconsin. We're getting a little more attention and love this year because of the competitive election, but I think we make a better contribution in general to public understanding by focusing on one state. This poll, though, is a unique area because no one else polls exclusively about the Supreme Court on a national level or ask the 70 questions that we asked about the court. So we're able to go into much more detail and provide a national look at the Supreme Court in a way that other survey organizations don't. So in that way, I think we're adding more to the public discussion than yet another poll of U.S. presidential preferences at the national level, which we could certainly do anytime we wanted to. It's just that I don't think the value added to that is as great.
And tomorrow, the law school is releasing another poll on public opinion in Wisconsin this time. What are some of the topics that you explored?
Well, of course, we're going to ask about impeachment and how the public feels about that and how their views have changed from last winter and spring. We'll look at the 2020 elections and the primaries, of course. But we also have some other things, including on gun issues, health care proposals, and my favorite items, deer hunters.
And Central Time will have our companion program in the afternoon. Central Time will be conversing with you on that poll. Charles, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll, professor of law and public policy. You can find a link, by the way, to the complete poll results on our program page at WPR.org. Just ahead, we hear about emotional and physical toll that helping people with their mental health can take on healthcare workers themselves. Then we explore the significance of a teacher's strike in Chicago. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.